Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of Savoir Faire, a Disco Elysium podcast. This is the first season of the Super Culture Review. Again, this season, we're focusing on a game that we all love, and as of recently, it's coming to light that everyone else loves it, too. Disco Elysium has, I would say, maybe swept the Game Awards. It definitely won a lot of stuff at the Game Awards. Other publications are starting to publish their end of year lists, and it's like coming out on top. So here to talk about Disco Elysium in more detail are my lovely co-hosts once again, Josh Calixto and Reed McCarter, and as always, I'm Kyle Cookstell. And I mean, guys, I don't think we were anticipating some of the love that Disco has seen since we started the podcast, especially because we started the podcast wanting to talk about Disco because we felt like people weren't really talking about it. And now it's like winning everything. So how do you guys feel about that?
I hate it now. I can't enjoy anything.
We're canceling the podcast now. Our work here is done.
I just keep picturing Jeff Keighley sitting in his fortress,
opening an envelope and reading the name Disco Elysium.
Yeah.
Just tainting the good name. No, I feel like, I mean, obviously this is exciting. The game deserves more credit and it deserves to be recognized and it deserves to be played by like a lot of people. And I think one of the important things too is that like the critical conversation is happening at the level that we want it to, because while I do think it's great that this game is getting more recognition, I still think there's so much more space for things to be said about this game because it hasn't all been said. And I feel like the conversation isn't as developed as maybe it should be, as maybe a game that like kind of took the zeitgeist for 3 weeks and we all burned out on talking about, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how long have you talked about Far Cry 5?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think it's good that it's like kind of surprising because I was kind of curious if people would actually enjoy this game like en masse, but it seems like they are, which I don't know. I don't care if something that I've never thought, oh, this was something smaller and now it's big and that's sad, or something that's awesome for them. It's getting recognition. It's a good game. People should play it. And also what Josh was saying, just like the more conversation about this thing, the better, I think.
Yeah, I think if anything, it's like going to inspire more people to play it, because like the review committees that dictate what wins a game at a publication are like, you know, 5 people. So even if a publication is championing a game, it's not like that's indicative of a lot of people playing it, or even honestly like them publishing a lot of stuff about it. But I do think what it does do is signal boost games that you might have chose to skip on. So I'm definitely hoping that this sort of has an effect for Disco where more people come to play it because more people are seeing more outlets saying that like, oh, this is our game of the year. So yeah, I agree with you guys for sure. I feel like that's my hope, is that this kind of opens a door to more people playing it. And then especially once they do the console release next year, which is rapidly approaching, there'll be even kind of a wider audience then. So maybe Disco Elysium back-to-back GOTY winner 2019 and 2020.
And as a side note, if you want to hear more about Disco Elysium, we talk about it at length on the Game of the Year episode of Bad End Podcast, which is now available. So go check that out. And then also
check this out, Josh.
Yeah.
We also talked about it at length on the Bullet Points Game of the Year podcast as well.
And the Bullet Points, you guys did your whole residency recently in December, was all on Disco Elysium. You guys published like 5 pieces on it?
That was November, but yeah, 4 pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Including by...
Let's check that out, too.
Your boy, Josh Calixto.
Yours truly. Yeah.
I think I want to... So I want to open up this episode. So we've talked about kind of the first third of the game. We talked a little bit about the second third. I think we're going to talk probably... We might get to the end of the game this episode. But to kind of to frame the kind of end of game discussion, and before we actually go on, you know, we were talking before the podcast that we do want to kind of let you guys know what kind of our plans for this podcast are, especially the Super Culture Review in general. Our intent is not to stop the podcast after we finish talking about just like the arc of the story. As we've said on this podcast multiple times, there's like a ton of stuff going on in this game. So even though this episode might cover the end of the game, we'll probably spend at least as many episodes, if not more, talking about just other stuff in the game, talking about the people, talking about the locations, quest lines, may even have a special guest on to talk about some other stuff. So this is not by any means the last episode of Savoir Faire. So, you know, rest assured, we'll keep talking about it. But Chris, Reed, was it the piece that Chris Bro published on your site that was kind of about, I wanted to frame the discussion of like the end of the game stuff, that was about kind of Kim Kitsuragi being wrong a lot? Was that you guys?
Yeah. And that was, yeah, that was the last one that we put up in the month. And that was Chris Bro. And he was sort of talking about, which was interesting. He was sort of saying that, like, how this game kind of like, you know, Kim says these things to you, that this is not this kind of story and this is not the kind of thing that's going to happen. And then it is. But like Chris's whole piece, just to like flatten it down, is sort of about this game, like playing with certain expectations, about maybe like strangeness and messiness and genre fiction and everything. And I think that's like a pretty interesting way to talk as well about the ending, which kind of like it funnels the game back in to a detective story a little bit more, but then also does it in a, I think, like a pretty off-kilter kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, I think an interesting thing about his piece was specifically how, I mean, that Josh mentioned the last episode of Bad End as well. We kind of talk about this, but how this piece specifically kind of highlights how all these kind of small decisions that you're making at any given point and all these things that feel like diversions and like Kim is telling you are diversions end up kind of mattering in sort of the long run. And I'm trying to think of like what kind of the first instance of that is in the third act. Like, do you guys remember kind of a turning point of the third act, so to speak, that was like this thing that felt insignificant is actually kind of important, like that kind of sets the tone for that back bit of the game?
Well, like I think the cryptid stuff goes from being, and that's also something like Maddie Chilton wrote about that on during the month as well. But some of the stuff about like the cryptid hunt, which is kind of like you meet the cryptid hunters, like these two, like an elderly couple, and you kind of think, well, maybe they're, well, like everything in the game, you can decide sort of how valid you think like they're out there cryptid hunt is, like they're looking for, what is it, the something phasmid,
it's like the Insolidian phasmid or something.
Yeah, it's like beyond, what is it, like you can only hear it at certain frequencies or something.
Oh no, that
like,
is the that's the that's, Col de Maqua.
Yes,
I think Col de Maqua or something. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that the one you read about or you start thinking about it? I had that as like one of the,
that's the one you can think about. And they also talk about it. But I think they're out there searching for the sound, the one that, yeah, the cryptid that's only a sound.
Yeah. But then like that stuff ends up being, and it'd be interesting too, if like the kind of aspects of Harry that we developed are dissimilar at all. I think Kyle, I think you and I were pretty similar. Josh might've been different. But the way the very end of the game, like the last like 20 minutes of the game, the cryptids come back in pretty pronounced form and end up being like, Josh, you've talked about this a lot, like the stuff at the Pale, which is kind of like running like an undercurrent throughout everything, ends up coming back in a big way with that cryptid stuff and like lots of different things, like even like talking to the bocce ball players.
Yeah.
Ends up being something extremely significant at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, really? For me, the older bocce ball player died, but I didn't read that as significant. What else happened there?
Well, he's like, correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, but when you get to the end of the game and you meet the deserter, what was it, Dross?
Yep.
And he's been waiting to kill one of them for most of his life, right? Like the fascist.
The one who dies.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry. I don't want to cut you off, but keep going. I remember now.
Yeah. So he's like, amongst all the sort of creepy stuff he does where he just hangs out, kind of watching everything going on in the neighborhood through his rifle scope. And he just like, doesn't he just like put him in his scope all the time and just watch him do stuff and just think about how he could kill him at any moment if he wanted to. And it's just like so central to what a like pathetic figure he is, where like this is what he's doing. And I think like you could understand what he's talking about without having talked to like the old soldiers, the bocce ball players, but it's so much richer. It's like everything. I think a lot of the stuff about the ending probably works regardless of what kind of stuff you've like spent time digging into, but it's just a lot richer when you know these guys. He's like, are these sort of like spent old men who just argue with each other constantly and play bocce.
Yeah. I want to actually jump back here because I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves talking about the end of the game. But let's talk about everyone's favorite little drug addicted child, Kuno. So
a cue soundbite now.
Yeah. So let's paint the scene here. You know, you're investigating a crime scene. You're asking around, asking people for help, and stumble across little old Kuno in the yard. He's just peacefully defacing things and throwing rocks and just being an all-around insane person. And
Kuno's like the classic like bad kid of like a suburban group of benign kids. Like he's the one that parents are like not stoked to let their kids hang out with. He's the one that like his parent, like he's the one that you go over to his house to like play Resident Evil when you're like 7 years old because his parents don't care.
Yeah, and he shows you his switchblades and he has the snake.
So apparently if you keep talking to him, you like meet his dad or something.
Yeah.
I never got that.
Oh, he just like blackball you?
Yeah, and I kept trying to pass this. I had to pass some like empathy check or something, and I never was able to pass it. And like I kept trying throughout the game. I tried like just creeping through, because you know how like sometimes if you take a different dialogue path, it'll like open up new options, even though like it'll show you the path grayed out.
Yes, it'll hide new options behind other. Yeah.
It's interesting. So, I mean, I kept on going through to like check every possible tree with that kid. No luck.
I was just going to say, where did you both end up with Kuno at the end of the game? Because that might be a good way to frame like the different paths of the Kuno experience.
Hey, Josh, you want to start? What is your...
Yeah, so he's just kind of chilling there. He doesn't really do much after... He didn't really do much for me. Yeah.
What about you, Kyle?
I did get to go see his dad, and then I think my game was actually bugged. So he like basically he's just kind of chilling a lot of the time, and eventually like in like his Kuno way, he's kind of like talking a big talk about like his dad being like the toughest dude around, and that he's got like drugs there or something that he needs you to get. I don't remember why you go to his house, but this, I mean, again, we're definitely spoiling the game on this podcast, so you know. You've already been warned. But you go to his dad's house and his dad is just like a fat drunk dude. Like he doesn't fight you. He's literally sleeping on the bed. He's just like snoring. Like I think when he's snoring, if you click on him under his breath, it's like, he says the word pig. Like he recognizes that you're there, but he's like too drunk to do anything. So he's just like, pigs.
Yeah.
But like the first few times I went there, I couldn't actually find the drugs. But they're just on like the desk. But then I went back one time and they were there. So I think my game kind of bugged. It wouldn't let me select it or something. But I went and got the drugs back from him. And I think I ended up like giving him half the drugs.
To Kuno?
I felt bad for... Yeah, to Kuno. And then like he was like, thanks, man. And then he like respected me more. But I didn't get like the crazy thing that can happen at the end of the game. I don't know if you got this or you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, so Kuno has a whole arc, which is worth saying, is that he starts out as like the shittiest, annoying kid who's just like a total ass. Like he's like the worst, but ends up, I don't know, reading or talk about your Kuno arc.
I mean, Kuno sucks the entire time. Like he kind of never stops sucking, but you just start feeling worse for him, like worse and worse. And I think like the more time you spend with him, the worse you feel for him. Like when you go and you see his dad.
Yeah.
And then you learn more things about, is her name Kunois?
Yeah.
His pal, who's like, I think the game describes her as being like Kuno's fucked up, but this girl is like on a whole other level. Like she seems like sort of like sociopathic.
Yeah, actually sociopathic, yeah.
So you find
she's
out
she's the
like,
one that's like, she's like over the fence, kind of like egging Kuno on this whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. And like when you, if you do have like a breakthrough with Kuno where you have breakthroughs with him, but it's never like until one near the end complete. But he'll like whisper to you so that she can't hear him because he's like actually afraid of her. So like you realize more over time that this kid who, which is like pretty, I guess, predictable arc for this shitty little kid who, you know, he's from like a super broken home and his best friend is like, he's essentially just scared of. But toward the end of the game, and I'm sure we'll talk about the shootout more, but Kim got, I think, hit in the leg in mine. And then Harry wakes up and Kuno comes to check on him. And then Kuno's like with him throughout the entire end of the game. Like he has a little icon in the bottom left and just like
that's him. Fucking crazy.
That's messed up.
Someone said that on like in some Discord or something. And I was like, excuse me, what? Kuno can become your partner.
Yeah, and he starts talking about how he wants to become a cop, I think. And then you can like try to essentially stop him from being a cop because he recognized that maybe he wouldn't be, or he'd be too good.
A good cop.
Or he'd be too good at it. Kuno like actually is the kind of kid I think who usually becomes a cop. Just like this little freak who has like realizes that having authority is a pretty cool thing for him. But yeah, and then he's with you throughout the end of the game and you keep trying to, I mean, at least the way it played out for me, I was like, you know, trying to figure out how to guide him toward being better. So he ends up like idolizing you. And then you have the responsibility of this little kid who is reacting to everything you do. Like talking about whether you're cool or stupid or anyway. So Kuno's right there talking to like the old communist. He's there with like the plasmid.
That's so crazy.
Or whatever.
Does he see the plasmid? Or the phas? Sorry,
no.
Phasmid. What's phasmid? I think it is.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't see it. If I'm remembering right, he doesn't see it, and he's like, "What? Who are you talking to?" And you can like tell him, and I think he is like, "Okay, sure, that's what you were doing."
Wait, he doesn't see it?
I don't think he sees it.
What? Kim sees it though, right?
Yeah. Kim takes a picture.
What?
Yeah.
He takes a picture of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, we should. So, okay. Yeah. We could talk more about that. Let's keep talking about Kuno, though. So, like, does he have sort of like a redemptive arc for you? Or is it kind of like he is just kind of continues being Kuno. Like, what is the ramifications of that at the very end of the game? Like, when you're kind of getting your, like, score, so to speak.
He's there with you and listening to everything. And I think you can kind of send him on his way with, like, don't quote me exactly on this because it's been a while now and there's a lot going on at the end. But he's listening to things. And so when you're kind of talking about your future as a cop, like, you're essentially talking to Kuno about it as well. And he has dialogue options and stuff too. Like, he pops in like the way Kim does. But in terms of his arc, it's just like, it's not like, I don't think anything in this game really ends with you feeling like, oh, these characters are all going to be great now. But Kuno, it's like, okay, yeah. This kid sees a way other than like standing around yelling homophobic slurs and throwing rocks at dead bodies, like, to live his life, you know? And like, he wants to become a cop. And I think that's one of the big takeaways, at least from how it went for mine. So I don't know, but like, you feel for him more and he's a more fully fleshed out character, I think, too, when he's coming along with you and just like remarking on things that you're doing and seeing. I think it's wild, though, that can just not happen. Like, he can either be this really central character or just yet another of the characters that you talk to for a long time in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I found that interesting too, just because for me, he does disappear somewhat early on into the game. But I mean, the stuff that replaces that almost feels like the main way for you to go about the game. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Having Kim there just feels intuitively like what should happen.
Right.
But did it feel to you like you were playing through some like weird alternate version of the game when you had Kuno there, or did it just feel natural?
It's kind of interesting because instead of Kim being this sort of calmer mediating influence, you have Kuno, who is like just this agent of chaos, and like less so than he is when you're hanging out in the courtyard with him. But it's a different vibe. It doesn't feel like, I don't know. It made sense the way it worked for me because there was a shootout. And then I think where things were left with Kim was that I think his leg was injured, but he was going to be okay. But he wasn't back in the field yet. He needed to like rest for a while. So it made sense with Kuno being like, hey, I was checking in on you. Like, you wake up in the hotel and Kuno's just fucking standing there hanging out. and essentially he's like, he doesn't know what to do with himself. So he's like, you kind of take him in. It just, to me, it kind of felt like an interesting way to see like a flip side of how Harry going about doing his weird shit might seem to another character in the world. Where, you know, the difference between Kim being sort of reasonable and knowing lots of stuff, and Kuno knows lots of stuff too, but he's weird. And you get the sense of feeling like this character is really paying attention to what you're doing because he's a kid and he has decided that you're cool after all.
That's really interesting when you consider, like, I think that when you're with Kim, there is a sort of like, you guys are both adults, right? So Kim is not influenced by your decisions kind of ever. He's just kind of watching you in amazement as you just like bumble your way through the case or whatever. I actually saw Knives Out last night, and I feel like the detective of that reminds me a lot of Harry Dubois, where he's just kind of this sort of bumbling, kind of gets it right eventually, but isn't necessarily totally acute. And I feel like Kim kind of sees Harry like that. But you know, like, what you're doing is Kim can kind of resign that to be like, oh, that's just how Harry is, you know? And I feel like actually having Kuno at your side all the time may make you, like you're saying, kind of rethink that and be like, oh, like, my actions actually have an influence on how this other person is perceiving. And they're like looking at me as a leader. And, you know, based on what I do, I'm influencing this person who I already see is so bad. And like, am I choosing to kind of continue to push him down this path? Because I don't think you ever get I'm trying to think of the dialogue options with Kuno. Like, I don't think Harry ever just kind of like is cool with letting Kuno be who Kuno is. Like, if he's ever trying to like bolster him up or reassure him, it's kind of for some other end to just kind of get him to calm down. But actually having him as your side as like a partner, I feel like would kind of like I say, like cast a sort of different light over your actions and kind of give them an honestly like a new like kind of moral heft, knowing that this kid is kind of watching you at all times.
I guess like, yeah, so many of the decisions you make with him before that are tempered somewhat by like practicality. Like you want stuff from right. Kuno. Kuno knows things about the murderer. And then also like, I don't know, what did you do with the speed from his dad's place?
Oh, I gave it to him.
You gave him some of it? I can't remember what I did. I don't think I gave it to him. I felt like that was a bridge too far to give Kuno his speed.
I feel like I couldn't tell. From my perspective, it didn't feel like he was actually like doing speed. It definitely felt like he was just kind of selling it. And he just had like Kuno reminds me a lot of like kind of kids in like elementary school that are kind of like, are like definitely ADHD, but haven't been necessarily diagnosed yet. So they end up kind of like acting a lot of weird ways that kind of makes people not want to be friends with them. And I felt like,
didn't they say he was like on drugs though?
I don't remember that, honestly.
Like in the, in like your perception of him, it's like, oh yeah, this kid's clearly on drugs. Like,
oh, my perception skill wasn't high, so it could be very likely that I just missed that.
I remember something like relatively definite about like, no, this kid is, and also like that there was like a physical desperation for him wanting to get some of that.
Oh man, I definitely, yeah. I don't think I got that at all. I just remember him like, because my really, I definitely was like, oh, he's just trying to sell drugs, and I was like, well, his dad is like a total shitbag. He doesn't have any money. Like, taking away this one thing that seems to like help him seems bad. Like, if I take away these drugs, what does he have left? His dad's bad. He's got a bad friend. I'm continuing the cycle of like, you know, bad behavior.
You're an enabler.
I'm an enabler, but also like, this guy's got nothing. So,
I mean, it's kind of interesting in terms of Kuno, I think, is a good character, not just because he's memorable and provokes like a very strong reaction when you first come.
Yeah, we should say that this is like the first guy you meet in the game.
Yeah, it's like the first time. And you there's go just outside,
this like
right?
little kid like yelling like slurs, and you're like, oh my god, what am I playing?
Yeah, there's the gardener like, who seems like a fairly normal person.
Yeah.
Which one's the gardener?
The one who gives you those gloves?
It's just the woman sitting outside in the corner.
Who ends up being the union or the... the Titus. She's the Hardy like the lawyer. Boys is like lawyer, yeah. And then you meet Kuno, who's just like day and night compared to her. What else do you got to say about Kuno Mars here?
I think it's weird that he's like always around. Like a lot of characters in Disco are kind of mobile, like they're kind of moving in and out, but where Kuno is at specifically means that you'll always encounter him kind of every day at the start. Like he's so close by and he's right next to the dead body. And so am I, because I put all my points into the what it's like physics or whatever, I can't remember what it's called, all the purple skills, I had like very low, it's like composure or like whatever like will of the body was.
The red one?
The red or yellow one? I can't remember. Oh,
there's a yellow
I think it's a
one
yellow
too.
One. I can't remember what it was called. But basically the skill that lets you actually approach the body without throwing up. Mine was so low for so long. So my body was up for like 3 or 4 days before I finally got it down. So every day I was going over there and seeing Kuno. And so you interact with Kuno like so much. In a way, it reminds me of a quote I read about like the tarot deck and how all the like a tarot deck has all these sort of cards that are all like proper suits and kind of are related to each other. But then there's like the jester. I can't remember what it's called, the Jester or the Joker or something. Basically, the Joker is the card that actually gives the rest of the deck meaning. So in some weird way, Kuno feels like the sort of skeleton key to the rest of Disco Elysium. And I think it's like it makes sense then in that way that of all the people in the game that could become your partner, this kid becomes a person that will actually be by your side at the very end. So I think it's like Reed, you were saying, it's kind of easy to try to write him off as like some one-off character. But I think that he's like much more central to Disco Elysium than I think really anybody understands or is like let on.
Yeah. I think it's pretty significant that he and Kuno East are the only kids, right? No, I guess there are some other kids in...
In West or East? West Rivershall. After you cross the bridge.
There's the shopkeeper's daughter.
But she's like a teen. Kuno's like, 10 or something.
Yeah, the kids over the bridge who are like playing little games and stuff.
I think he's like definitely the most fleshed out kid, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like absolutely. The one who you actually get to spend the most time with. And I don't know. It's interesting to think, like Kyle is saying, that he's sort of central to a lot of what's going on. And, you know, especially if you get him as a partner or you manage to keep having conversations with him enough to go and try to find his dad and everything, you kind of get the sense like this kid is going to be an adult very soon, and this is the world that he's growing up in. And you know, the sense of like desperation and everything, it's just in the neighborhood is Martinez and the city is Rivershall.
I think what we're kind of like creeping around here too is that like a lot of the game is about what we kind of like inherit from the things that came before us, right? Like, you know, you have this like revolution that didn't pan out, and the whole like setting of the game is a byproduct of that. And everyone in the game is influenced by that and is shaped by that fact. And is kind of like living in this, well, what do we do now? Like, what is our presence? What is our meaning? Like, what are we all about? And then you have like Kuno, which is the next generation after that, which is just like, if he is any representative of what to look forward to in that generation, even more fucked. Cause you know, this is a kid doing drugs out in the street, throwing rocks at dead bodies on trees, like the ultimate zoomer over here. And
he's doing it all for the TikTok, though, throwing those rocks at dead bodies and trees.
Well, and I think that it's interesting that you can have him at the end as like this figure that is clearly influenced by you, that like, and you know, Harry's not the best example of a person to be following, or is he? You know, like, I don't know. There's all this stuff going on with that and inheritance and the, you know, what we get from the people who came before us and how our predecessors influence us, that I think is important when it comes to Kuno, for sure.
I would not be surprised whatsoever if they make a continuation of this story, if you see old Kuno showing up as like a young adult. I think would be an interesting character. Yeah.
Disco Elysium 2, starring Kuno.
Kuno. Actually, I remember reading an interview with them where they said that if they made a second game, they'd want it to star a pregnant woman, which is like, whoa.
What?
Yeah. That was like,
oh my God. Yeah, that's it.
It's just like, that's the level that they're on.
That is next level.
I think, well, I mean, if we're talking about Kuno, it's worth talking about maybe his foil in some ways, who is like Cindy the Skull. Is that her name? The kind of like someone, she's like older than Kuno probably, but she's not as old, I think, as the bookkeeper's daughter. But she's like the one who's kind of like, it's so weird, right? Like talking about this notion of inheritance. Cindy is like this character who seems to be like, for a cause that isn't a cause. Like she's just kind of like a revolutionary without a revolution. She's just like painting red stuff and just being like, I'm mad at the system. And then I feel like when you talk to her, it's not like she has any sort of like backing for what she's mad about. But in the same way that kind of Kuno is kind of like hates everything. She hates everything too, but in a kind of a different way. And is like trying to change it. Like she's the one right after the shootout that like does like the oil burn onto the ground of, I can't remember what the words are.
Oh yeah. I have them
screenshotted. Surely.
It's,
I can't remember what she says, but it's just like talking about like the kids and what we inherit. Like, what was your guys' impression of Cindy as a character? Cause I feel like I kind of dried up on her. Like I ended up not being able to pass some of her checks. Like I failed kind of one really big red check. And I think I basically locked me out of everything else. But I don't know if you guys had a different experience with her.
Yeah. Same thing happened to me, but I also got that impression, Kyle, same thing as you, where it's like, what is she about? Like, what does she really stand for? And it almost felt like she was unapproachable to like anyone. Everyone felt like Cindy the Skull was like this intimidating character that like you couldn't really get close to. She was like always so closed off. Even when it would like, when she would kind of just stand there and talk with you, she would like give you shit and stuff, but it seemed like she was okay with talking to you. But then, yeah, she's just like this impenetrable fortress that you just like can't get through to. And I do feel like there's like a lot of misplaced or just like ambiguously placed rage within her, where she's like, she knows that stuff is wrong and she like knows that she has to do something about it. But like, what is there to do? Like, she doesn't really have any way to demonstrate that or like have that manifest as change in the real world. So she just like burns the ground in like the shape of letters and like paint stuff red.
Well, you know what she burns onto the ground? I found a screenshot of it. It is in French. One day I will return to your side, which is pretty perfect.
Right, right. What do we make of that? What's our reading on that?
I think she's like, I think what you're saying, like to me, she very much seemed like the kind of teenage spirit of, like when you get old enough to realize that the world is shit and unfair, but you're not, maybe you haven't formed enough of an, you don't have an informed enough opinion yet to really know what you think the way the world should be, you know, how to start fixing these things. You don't have an ideology maybe, or like a good understanding of like concrete things that can be done. So she's just like this burning spirit of kind of revolution in general, of change. And so I kind of thought that, you know, the shootout, which is like this culmination of all the simmering tensions and everything, and to me her writing "one day I will return to your side" is just like, I don't know, maybe a little bit too abstract of a reading, but just seemed like the idea of like these things will happen again, these are these big moments of kind of like violent change are inevitable and will keep coming back.
Yeah, and there's something like weirdly, I think she always had she has that feeling kind of in the background where you feel like she could be a great ally. You feel like she could make something great happen, that she has like this potential inside her. And I feel like Harry sees that in kind of Kuno too, right? Like, you know, he doesn't seem to be a completely lost cause, you know, like you want, you know, these people to head in the right direction. And so I think there's like, there's definitely some positivity with that message of, and like hope even, which is different for this game. And I do remember that quote having me feel some type of way, because there is this like promise of like, I'll be back, this promise of like things will be different, or that like there's that something could change, which is not a sentiment you hear very much in Disco Elysium.
That's like a lot of what I took away from the end though, is this idea that, you know, things could get better, but they will get better through like not inertia, not being the old sniper living in isolation, just watching everything through a rifle scope and creeping around at night. Like that these actual like really engaged, motivated people are out there, and they're frustrated, and they're trying to figure out the best way to channel that frustration, which is, I think, like a hopeful message, especially when it comes to like the young characters in the game.
Yeah.
Who do you think is like the I in that statement? Do you think Cindy's talking about herself?
More like the idea of what she represents, you know? But then at the same time, like that's very, like I said, I don't know if that's too abstract.
I mean, I feel like that's.
But also she's like a little poet.
Yeah, right? I feel like it's definitely my read is that it would be kind of like what she stands for. But then I think the other question is like, if that's her ideology as the I, like who is the, like whose side? Is it like Martinez's side? Like, is it about that, like her ideology, like revolution will come back to Martinez at some point, you know?
That's how I read it, because it's like the site of this, you know, this big shootout that presumably the whole neighborhood would have known right there. That's where something really big and violent, like this confrontation between the union and the police and the, what would you call them? Like the kind of like fascist soldiers or like the enforcers or whatever. So I kind of took it as maybe you could even read it as like a confrontation of that kind of something climactic and maybe violent even is going to come back to the neighborhood.
I also felt sort of the way you felt, Reed, which is there was some hope in the ending, but I also felt like kind of underlying nihilism or like just intense, like deep nothingness beneath it all.
Oh yeah.
That was also like kind of dreadful at the same time.
Like I was thinking about this a lot more too, and I was like trying to figure out what my favorite game of the year was. And I think this game is, I don't know, it captures the spirit of the times. If you're frustrated by the state of the world, which I think quite a few people are, you know, like the idea that like things fucking suck and don't seem like, you know, you even look at like the UK elections recently or in Canada here, like our last elections, and you just think like fuck, like people are so fed up and they're trying to enact change. Well, I mean, maybe that's part of why we're in the situation we are too, is that other kinds of people are fed up and trying to enact their own abhorrent kind of change. And it's just like you look at the history of the world over the last 100 years and longer, and it's just like, well, why is there a lot of reason to feel hopeful?
Right.
You know, but there is also at the same time like the frustrations and like the yearning and people like kind of having had enough of a lot of what's going on. Like all that kind of stuff is, I think, channeled very well, and not like, not in a way that's too simple, like overly simplistic or patronizing.
Yeah. And the complexity.
Disco Elysium.
And then the underlying fact that like nothing means anything. And there's just like all this, all the layers are there, you know,
but it spends so much time like in Harry's head and making sure every character you meet feels like a person, that it's like a very humanistic game too. Like it's nihilistic, but it also says, look at these people, like they all want things.
Yes.
And a lot of them deserve to have some kind of happiness.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's why I feel like a little bit of both going on. And I think Harry's relationship with the Pale is also kind of like a vindication of a lot of the stuff that he does and a lot of the ways that he behaves, you know, where he's like stared into the void, and it's like now spoken back to him at the end of the game. And there's a lot there that like I feel like I need to unpack. Maybe we could do that a little bit more next episode. Can we talk about the dead body on the boardwalk?
Yeah.
A little bit. So
yeah.
You're doing your just like routine investigation stuff. I think I was in the process of looking for my gun or something like that. And you go on this boardwalk, and then there's just a dead dude just sitting there. He's like frozen up. Body's still not super fresh, but you know, it's still there. Another second dead body you just find out in the wild. And you find some information about him, and you do some investigating and find out, you know, where he's from. And you ultimately go and you meet his wife, yeah?
I had a different way that this happened.
Okay.
But I'm interested to know. So Josh, you basically, you found him. And then what was your investigating like after that? Like you found this body and then what did that mean for like what you were doing in the game?
Don't really remember what happened, what the process was like. I think I called it into the station and like they approved that I could start. They proved that like they said like, okay, I'll go ahead, investigate that or whatever as a side thing. Just don't let it get in the way or something like that. Or there was some sort of like, I asked Cam if it was okay to like pursue this line of investigation. And I did. I don't remember what exactly happened. What happened for you guys?
Actually, Bido, how did yours happen? Because I want to hear. My thing was kind of weird, so yeah, I want to know what happened with you.
Mine was like the kind of the flip of what Josh was saying, where I talked to his wife
first. Yeah, me too.
And I think it was like one of the last like lingering quest things I had toward the end of the game was find her husband. Like for some reason I never ended up, it might have been after like trying to find the gun as well, or maybe I don't know if I had it at that point, but for whatever reason I eventually ended up, and I thought for a long time those three the three guys who hang around the fire in the slum area, I thought the guy who wouldn't talk was her husband for a long time, and I couldn't figure out
The lady who you're talking to and you just keep asking like, where's your husband?
Yeah.
You're just like prying into her life for no reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was being real.
I was doing the same thing, Reed, which is so crazy because it was literally like the game. This is like the whole thing about small decisions not actually mattering. This feels like the most important one because you can just keep probing her and being like, yeah, exactly. Like being a total dingus to this person and being like, no, like, where's your husband at? She's like, he's fine. And you're like, no, but like, do you know where he's at? She's like, he's probably somewhere. And he's like, do you know where? And it's this weird sort of like hole of conversation that you can go with her. And then she disappears too. Like I think she leaves that area after like the second day or something, but she
goes back to her apartment or something. Doesn't she?
Yeah. I mean, yes, probably.
I totally forgot about that part. Yeah. That did happen for me.
Okay.
But what's interesting is that this is like Harry's method is like, he throws out some real weird wild card shit and then people respond to it in a way that's like, then that's what he latches onto. Cause he starts saying some weird stuff to her that just he shouldn't say. And he notices that she's like, she has a kind of concerned look on her face or maybe not even at that level of perception, but he sniffs out some like deep fear inside her and he just keeps probing and probing and probing and he's like, something's going on here. And that's, I feel like what he always does, which is throws out something weird as bait. That's what they encourage you to do in this game where they say like, you're a cop, you can kind of say whatever you want. So just do it, just say your shit. And he throws out something totally unexpected, people respond to it, and then he latches onto that. The human can opener just goes for it. and a lot of times he ends up being right because the shit that people are hiding is usually, you know, it's dark, it's unexpected, it's something like you might never expect from this person. I think that kind of goes along with like Kim's logical approach. And Chris Bro's piece on bullet points about how everything that happens is kind of unexpected, because I think some of the darkest things and some of the things that like a lot of the shit that happens in this world is stuff that you're never going to know is happening because everyone's got their dark side. Everyone has their weird shit that they do that has real world impacts that we can never perceive as being, the direct consequence of something that someone did while no one else was looking, you know? Like, think of how many internet trolls are out there that, like, you're never going to know who they are. And then think about how many of those people are, like, people that you know in real life who just will never, that information will never come to light, that they are, like, on 4chan, like, freaking closet people who are hopping in Patrick Klepek's mentions and calling him bad names. You know what I'm saying?
I had a really weird experience. Like, we talked about this in the last episode about how, like, Disco Elysium has like a Tetris effect style effect on your thinking about kind of like, you know, oh, if I would have just passed my conceptualization check, I could have foreseen this thing in my real life or something. But I've like actually found myself to be like a little more Harry Dubois in some of my daily stuff, like in asking people questions for the bit, like for good parts. But so like I was at this actually at like a funeral. It was not a reception. It was like a memorial service for this guy who had passed. And that's just the context. That's not relevant to the story. But I saw a friend of mine and we were just like talking, and then we ended up talking about like pictures. And then he kind of like made some offhand comment that he usually has his phone with him. And I was like, oh, well, do you take pictures? And he's like, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, oh, what do you take pictures of? And he was like, oh, well, like, I don't know. Like, I just have it with me and just take it or whatever. I'm like, well, like, you take pictures a lot then? Like, or what do you? So, and then we end up getting there, and it turns out he always takes pictures of his food. And he takes pictures of his food because, like, he likes the idea of remembering the meal, even if the light is bad. It's not about a good picture. It's about, like, you know, how he wants to remember a meal for, like, the people that were there versus, like, wanting to take, like, a beautiful picture for Instagram. And he never shares it or anything. They're just pictures that live on his phone. So it kind of went from this, like, weird, like, offhand comment about him taking pictures to then, like, him opening up his phone and showing me all of his food pictures. And like, we started talking about like photography and like the kind of like the role of an image when everyone has a camera. And it felt like very Disco Elysium because it was this small little thing that I was like pulling at the thread of to like see what happened. And it turned out to like have this sort of deep humanism behind it. Like you're saying, I mean, this wasn't like some dark secret. This guy wasn't a secret internet troll, at least that I found out.
Right.
But it was a sort of thing where like, there's so much more to people if you just start to dig and actually kind of like probe and what people are kind of interested in and kind of go beneath the veneer. Like with this woman whose husband died, it's like you could easily talk to her like for 5 minutes in the game and still think nothing is wrong. But if you just like keep asking her questions, eventually she's like, actually, yeah, I haven't seen him for a few days. I'd love to know what's up with him. But like, you would not know that just from a single talking to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, I don't know, her whole thing too is a lot of stuff, but like kind of pushing at the boundaries of social convention and everything, and ends up being like this very kind of heartbreaking story of like a marriage that's fallen apart and like, you know, they aren't talking to each other and he's regularly vanishing, and then to the point where he's frozen.
And the other thing too is that I think the game kind of frames this whole thing as Harry having almost gone too far, you know, where at the end of this line, you end up going to her place and your role is to, all you can really do is give her the news and try to comfort her. And Kim kind of has you do that because he's like, yo, you're the one who wanted to pursue this, so you got to tell her.
Right.
And he's like trying to give, he feels bad for you, so he's like trying to give you pointers on like, you know, you should do it like this, or like you should, you know, approach it this way. But I failed just terribly.
Oh, really?
And yeah, he did a really bad job because he just couldn't get the words out. He didn't know what to say. He didn't say anything that was necessarily like shitty, but he just did not do a good job of comforting her whatsoever. And he just leaves and he's just defeated. And he's like, oh, why did I do this? He's just like depressed. The void, the pale starts creeping in again. And it was just a very kind of, it was like, damn, maybe that wasn't worth it. Maybe I should have just like called in this thing and not like done all this stuff and probed into this person's life, because yeah, as the human can opener, like that's what he does, but maybe he doesn't always have the desired effect, or maybe sometimes you have to deal with the consequences.
Yeah. That's interesting, and probably maybe a bit more interesting. Well, maybe not. Then, like, because the way it was kind of left for me was he tells her, and it wasn't like super remarkable. Like, if anything, she seemed ultimately relieved. Yeah. And like the feeling was like, well, at least now she knows, you know, that as sad as it is, at least there's some kind of ending or like something definite to the fact that her husband just keeps like going away and drinking and disappearing for days.
Yeah.
Where it felt like, but yeah, like yours makes it seem like maybe you shouldn't have been doing this. Whereas the way it went for me and Kyle, it sounds like, was like, well, maybe you did the right thing by kind of like pushing past where you're supposed to.
Oh, okay. God, see, that's like, that's interesting because it's like two different reads on the same character based on the outcome of this one mission.
Yeah, and like the same idea too.
Well, also,
yeah,
it had like the another effect on me, which was that it felt like it was like a really interesting contrast to kind of like the main quest line, so to speak, of the game. Where in some ways this felt like, you know, the good detective work. It like was like not, it was like the ideal sort of like case that you'd want as a detective. It's like, oh no, there's a dead body. There's a few clues. Let's tie these together. Oh, there, we got it. It works. That was her husband. He died from drinking. Let's go tell her, sorry, like pat your hands. We did it. Good job, everybody. Compared to kind of like the morass of like, the case of the dead body. So in some ways, like kind of like Reed was saying, it felt like that this is what the work is supposed to look like. It's like, this is Harry operating at his best, where he's like remembering details, like that the wife mentioned that she sewed him this like coat that he loved with this like blue inner lining or something. And how all these little things kind of come together and Harry just quickly solves it. And so it feels like he's like at the top of his game. And it feels like to me, like you basically get a glimpse of what it's actually like to kind of be Harry when he's at his best, not sort of like, you know, in the middle of a case where he just got blackout drunk as part of it. So it was, yeah, I think like the contrast for me is what stood out. It didn't have the sort of same sort of like, I mean, Josh, it sounds like what you had was like really kind of, was like really different, where it's, it makes you kind of reconsider your whole method, you know? Because I definitely had a situation where it was like, you know, the Dubois method works. We get shit done.
I have a question that I want to pose for y'all, which is, where do you think that this comes from? Where do you think that Harry's inquisitive nature comes from? Is it because he's curious about people? Is it because he wants to be a good detective? Is it because he needs to... he has like some nagging thing in his subconscious that says, ask about this. What do you think this comes from?
I think my first thought is that he's like seeking meaning. I don't think we have enough time to necessarily talk about like the dream sequence, but to me that felt like it really kind of like codified a lot of his sort of mentality, even with his old relationship with his ex-wife. Is that he's like kind of like always looking for like truth or something, or like just seeking something. And so he's just kind of like this wandering spirit that can basically never settle, and like nothing is necessarily ever good enough for him. And that detective work kind of like aligns with this mentality. Well, there's always another case. There's always like some more truth hidden around. There's always like a little bit more behind the person who you're talking to than they're initially letting on. So I think
he wants there to be. He wants there to be.
More. Like he needs there to be. It's like he needs there to be more all the time. And so I think
even in the shipping container.
Yeah.
Even in the shipping container, there's gotta be something there. Obviously, there's a way to get inside of it. Like everything has to have meaning. Everything that Kim says shouldn't have meaning has to have meaning.
That's like that's a really good point, and makes me glad that I asked that question, because that's like, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's demonstrated so many times throughout this game where it's not just that he cares about this person and he wants this best for them. It's like something a little bit deeper than that, something a little bit maybe more sinister in some ways, but it does result in him being a good ass detective and getting shit done and also like helping people out in the long term in some cases, because, you know, there's that moment where, you know, you uncover his badge and Kim looks at your badge and he's just like extremely impressed by the numbers on there.
He's like, Sekhety Frieder.
Oh yeah.
He's like, you only killed that many people, like, and you solved that many cases. He's just like, that is extremely unusual for someone who's been in the field as long as you have. And he's like, he kind of looks at you differently after that. He's like, this guy is like actually legit as hell. Like, what is going on? He doesn't really let that on, but you can tell that he's impressed.
I think, Kyle, like, I agree pretty much exactly with what you said about why Harry is like written that way. And I think it ties into with sort of what this game is on, like, even a mechanical like design level and on like a thematic level too, where like the kind of stuff we were talking about before with excuse me for saying, but it's like a very postmodern RPG where it's like the idea of what the definite truth is, or the idea, like, there's almost a sense that it's impossible to find. There is no one truth, right? There is no simple answer to what's going on. Everything, including political and moral systems, are confused, and a sense of self and psychology and everything are all, you know, nothing is definite. Nothing is simple. And Harry, all the same, wants there to be at least something that makes sense. And then you, as the player, and the game facilitates this, are like trying to dig through, like, not just the world and like different, you know, different kind of like political ideologies and everything, but also like the character's mind, which is like tries to like capture some sense of like how contradictory and multifaceted like the human brain is, and just like your outlook on the world and everything. And Harry is like kind of the perfect, like, as a detective to be still, even though everything's confusing and like kind of alienating, like so alienating that he wakes up having gone on such like an incredible bender that has fucking amnesia, but he still has to try to find some kind of truth. And that's like a kernel of something that to me seems like the whole point of this game is, even though everything, it could be really easy to say this is all too confusing, just like the way it would be really easy to say everything here sucks so much. But you still have to try to find something, no matter how small, that is, like, you know, the capital T truth. And that's part of, I think, why, like, it's just really well put together, all these different ways to present this kind of story.
I mean, when you bring that up, it's interesting to think about in the context of this mission where you're telling this woman that her husband just died, because the outcome of that was so different for both me and you. You know, like, the outcome of this game of like hanging out with Kuno instead of with Kim is so different. And you're able to live out so many alternate versions of the truth. And like, it's interesting because you rarely see in games where like the gameplay decisions and the way that the systems work is very intricately tied in with what the game is trying to say, right? There's that dissonance, if you will, between what's going on in the game and in its systems. And I think that whole conversation has been so stunted by the fact that, like, everything has been, like, shooting is, like, the gameplay mechanic that you talk about.
And audio diaries. Then
the narrative part is, like, good and evil. You know what I'm saying? Where, like, that's literally all the variables that you have to plug into the ludonarrative dissonance conversation. And that's such a stunted way of looking at it. But I think one of disco's the things that's nutty about it is that it introduces so many more variables of like the way that its checks work, the way that truth is portrayed as far as like what seems canonical and what doesn't. Like all this stuff is like stuff that they are saying things with, right? Like that little passage that I shared in one, a previous episode about how in the way that Harry thinks about things and how he doesn't manifest those things into the world. These are all philosophies that are portrayed within the system. And I think it's interesting when we talk about the idea, the concept of truth as something that Harry is constantly seeking out, because the game itself doesn't offer one truth. It offers a lot of confusing kind of possibilities and branching paths that are like, is this the way this was supposed to happen? Is this the way, you know, and yet everything still feels so natural at the same time. I it's the kind of thing where I just want to pick the studio's brains about this, just because, you know, I want to know like what were you trying to portray here? What was the idea behind this? Because it is very clear that a lot of thought has gone into how these systems tie in with what's going on in the main character's head and what the game is trying to get you to think about. And I just think that's another example of it.
Yeah, absolutely. The way the game does end up feels like it is pointing, well, I don't know. It ends up in a place where I think it's accommodating to various aspects of the same truth, kind of, that it's kind of trying to point you toward, if that makes sense. I think maybe this is something that I'll touch on more when we talk about, like, specifically the final little bit of the game. Like, after...
Yeah.
After the climax of it, there's maybe about 15 or 20 minutes where I think a lot of stuff kind of coalesces in terms of what the game, I think, is trying to point you toward. But at the same time, it also accommodates lots of different ways that you could have gotten there.
I think, well, I mean, another thing, except like something similar is too, is that like I feel like the game also, it like posits this notion of like always having more truth as well. Like you could pretty quickly in the game kind of like accept a certain type of the truth and then work with that. But obviously like there's literally a physical limit to how much dialogue is in the game. Like that exists. But at the same time, like, the game gives the impression that there's always like they would write an infinite amount of dialogue for this if they could. I think we mentioned on the first episode, I think it was this podcast, that like by word count, Disco Elysium is like one of the longest books ever written. Like it's like in the top 10 or something. But like regardless, specifically how the game kind of rewards, not only like read what you're saying, we're kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I might be misunderstanding you, but in the sense that it's giving credence to like both sides of a truth, or even like in a third dimension of that. But there's always kind of more. Like everything kind of unfolds itself more and more and more over time, almost in the sense that it starts to like come back to the start again. It's kind of this like circle of truth where the more you start to dig, the more you start feeling like you're starting to talk about the same things or seeing the same things again. But it still feels like you're always digging. Like I think about the road in Kentucky Route Zero. That's like actually kind of like, it's actually an infinite loop that loops back on itself, where you're always discovering more, but you're always coming back at the same time. There's something to be said there about like repetition in games as sort of like a thematic concept, but specifically, I'm getting at the idea that if truth is sort of like the point of Disco Elysium, is that it's less about that there is a truth, but that there is always more truth. And drawing the line about where that truth exists for you as a person is like always a messy and imprecise process. But like you have to keep living. You can't just like look for the ultimate thing. And this is kind of like what I was saying earlier. This is like the, you know, this is the melancholy of Harry Dubois, is that he will always keep pushing forward to that truth and never stop, even when other people have settled for other versions or variations of that. So it's a never ending push that Harry is on, but also the game is interested in portraying for you.
That is, I think, that's a perfect way to put it, I think. And also contrasts pretty well with, like, just a addendum on that, like the characters you meet who are maybe kind of the saddest, or not saddest, but like that the game kind of shows as being maybe the stupidest in a way, are the people whose minds have been made up with the most limiting forms of truth that there is. Like, what's his name?
Measurehead.
Something head. Yeah. Like this guy who has limited his worldview into just essentially categorizing things, like into like a lexicon of fucking hate, you know? Like, it's, I think, a really good way of, without being having to be super explicit, and sometimes the game is explicit about being like, come on, this guy is the worst, including like the racist lorry driver, but just being like, look at this guy, like these characters who are actually trying to deal with the world and deal with something that's like maybe a bit better than what there is, are people, are the characters who have the most depth. And then, you know, are kind of like leading you down these long conversational routes about different concepts. But then here's, you know, your racist who just says like, your head's the wrong shape, so therefore you're this. And it's like, okay, well, this guy's like a lost cause, essentially. He's bought into something that is so limiting that it's, you know, it's not going anywhere. It's like a sad dead end of a way to think about the world. But yeah,
it's the whole, you know, ignorance is bliss type deal, you know what I'm saying? And the more Harry knows, the harder things get. That's for damn sure.
Should we talk about anything else, or should we,
I feel like this is a good place to end for this episode.
Think as a preview, we could talk a little bit more about the cryptid, the phasmid.
Yeah.
We could talk a little bit more about the ending of the game. We could talk about Ruby, which we didn't get to. We wanted to do. And then a little bit more about the shootout. So the big, big events we can kind of get to next week. And then I'm sure we'll come up with some more ideas for what to talk about after that. Because I feel like we're jumping out of time here. But it's because we're tying together themes that have relevance at different points in the plot. And so we can kind of get to those ideas next week and see where they lead us. But we'll be back for a few more episodes. Anybody have anything else they'd like to add before I wrap things up?
I would just say, I don't know when exactly this will go up, but I think just to shout out, if you're listening to this, to the stuff we've both been doing on both of our sites, on Bullet Points and on Bad End, for like the 2010 stuff.
Go.
There's a whole filthy amount of material.
Go read the November issue of Bullet Points Monthly at bulletpointsmonthly.com.
With the hot new redesign.
With the hot new redesign. From friend of the show, Dan Fries. Go check out Bad End Podcast. And we are also on Twitter at the Superculture Rev is the handle for our Twitter.
Just Superculture
Rev. Superculture Rev. Sorry. And then you can rate us and review us on iTunes or wherever you are listening to this podcast. We'd really, really appreciate that. On Bad End, we talk about this game. And then also on Bullet Points, we talk about this game in our most recent Game of the Year episodes. So go check that stuff out. And we'll see you soon.